This program is supported by a grant from Seagate Technology. Seagate is a worldwide supplier of disk drives for PCs and servers, and innovations for products like the Microsoft Xbox, digital video recorders, and digital jukeboxes. Information is at Seagate.com. It is Friday, March 5th, 2004, 10 a.m. on the central coast of California, and it's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name's Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on Geek Speak, we have Scott Baker, Senior Product Manager for NVIDIA, to take us on a tour of the NVIDIA Inforce Media and Communications Processor, or chipset. During the second half of the show, I'll welcome you to join our conversation. The numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Or you can go to geekspeak.org, click on The Geeks, and then send a message. I'll be giving out the contact information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks: John Tracy, owner and operator of FeltonGames.com; Miles Elam, programmer and student of American Literature; and Sean Cleveland, technical marketing manager for Transmeta. Geeks, welcome to Geek Speak.
Morning. Good morning.
Before we dive into a discussion about NVIDIA's Inforce and invite Scott and Brian to join our conversation, let's do a little geek news. I think we'll start today with Miles.
And my mic is up. Okay.
Yeah, you're here, Miles.
Right. Sorry. I saw your mouth high, but I didn't hear you.
Okay. Viruses. Everybody knows about them. My Doom has been one that's been in the news recently. But also, there are 800 new viruses every month.
Ooh.
Just to give someone an idea, and My Doom is just one of them.
We're talking about computer viruses, right? Because it's Geek Speak.
Okay. Right. And there's a new virus out, or at least a new form of it, a new form of social engineering that I've seen recently. And it manifested itself in a couple of mailing lists and on the Cruise.io, seeming to come from Cruise.io.
A big ISP in this area?
Right. And I'm sure it's happening other places because, as I said, I'm seeing it also on technical mailing lists, where it will say, you know, dear user of our service, sorry for an inconvenience, this service will be down. If you want to contact us, just click on the attachment.
And the attachment's a virus.
Right.
That's
so
evil.
It basically, the email is constructed in such a way that makes you think that, oh, it's the friendly people just trying to help me out, when in fact it has nothing to do with them. The return address, the email address that it comes from, is not the actual person.
So when you say that, take for example, Cruise.io, what would the email, if I had an account at Cruise.io, what would happen? Like, let's say we were miles.elam@cruise.io.com was the email address. What would this email that came to that account look like?
It would look like a fairly plain, simple email. It says, dear user of email server cruise.io.com, or main mailing server is temporary and unavailable for the next 2 days. To continue receiving mail in these days, you have to configure our free auto-forwarding service.
It really sounds like it's from the ISP.
For further details, see the attached. Sincerely, the Cruise.io.com team.
Ah, and that's the trick right there, is that they're actually using the domain name as the company administration group.
Right, and it's a virus. Do not click on the attachment. Just to give you an idea, no reputable service is going to send you information like that.
Yeah.
Cruise.io is never going to send an attachment like that. They're either going to give the information in the email itself just as text, or they're going to give you a web URL. And that's going to be true of 99% of the people, legitimate entities out there on the net.
And that's a good point, that now with email having rich text availability, or HTML really capability, where you can bold things, you can make headlines in your email, there's really no reason to make an attachment. People do it a lot with Word documents. That's the most common use of attachments, is you format a really nice letter and make it a Word document, then you attach that to your email, and then the person opens it, and it looks just like the way you wrote it. But because viruses are so pernicious now, it makes a lot of sense at this point to just stop using attachments.
And if you have questions, call your ISP.
Yeah, you can, of course,
pick up the phone. And also, don't send confidential data back over the Internet. Don't answer questions. This is a problem with eBay. You'll get a letter saying that your account with eBay has problems and they need your information to be verified. So you'll fill out a form that's provided in the email, but that form's not going back to eBay. It's going to another source.
Yeah, similar to the folks that are saying, we don't have your account set up correctly. Could you send your credit card number again?
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, Miles, thank you very much for that. Don't open attachments.
Yeah, and as a final note, this, as usual, is a Windows-only virus.
Right.
If you have a Mac, if you have a Mac, you don't need to worry so much about it. You should still delete it, but it's not quite as dire a proposition. If you're on Windows, keep your guard up.
All right. Thank you very much, Miles, for that bit of information. And Sean, hi.
Yeah, buying a laptop computer or LCD monitor is going to be a little more expensive starting July 1st. This is after a decision about hazardous waste that they contain. I guess the Department of Toxic Substances Control ground up a bunch of laptops and LCD monitors and found high contents of copper and lead, which are both toxic to groundwater.
We've been talking about CRTs, which is the traditional television-type monitor where it's really big and thick and that has lead in it, and we got to dispose of it correctly, and there's recycling costs, and everyone's like, well, we got it. Flat panels are coming, flat panels are coming, but flat panels are not the solution to the problem.
Right, and I guess they're not getting the money on the back end, so they're going to...
So they're just going to tack on
the cost of the product.
Is this a federal thing?
Well, this falls under an e-waste law that was written by State Senator Byron Scher last year. So this is only for the state of California.
All right. Well, it does make sense, though. You start paying for it right up front, and then you'll have the money to take care of recycling needs. To learn more about recycling needs, there's a little bit of article up on geekspeak.org about recycling computer waste in Santa Cruz area and beyond. Thank you, Sean, for that little bit tidbit. Hi, yeah. John.
Good morning. Another thing I've noticed about that is less than 4 years ago, you used to be able to go and take your monitor up to the local landfill and just dump it off.
Mm-hmm.
And then right after that, it was you could dump two monitors off for free.
And we're talking about dump, meaning give it to them in a specific location, and then they go
No, originally you could just dump it.
Oh, okay.
Then you could take two monitors in for free and put them in the special place. And then they charged you, I think, $2 per monitor after that. Then you could bring one monitor for free, and they charged you, I think it was $10 per monitor after that. Then you couldn't bring anyone for free, and they were all $10, and now they were $20 each. So this is kind of following the same vein as that.
They're catching up with themselves on recycling.
They're realizing that this is a major problem, and that they're finally enacting laws that force the county to take action.
Yeah. Right. Well, and it does make sense, because, of course, without that, people start dumping their monitors in the streets. I mean,
right.
Getting it, using as trash, and then doesn't get recycled.
Or on really the beaches in China. Right.
Right, of course.
Okay.
All right, good story.
In other news... water has been found on Mars. This really is kind of old news. Not since Wednesday, but also in 2000, there was an orbiter called the Mars Global Surveyor that found brine seepage.
Well, water wasn't found.
Well, water wasn't found, but evidence of water was found strongly enough to suggest that there was, to make a headline, water found on Mars. This is
right.
Back in 2000.
But this Wednesday.
Earlier this year, January, the ESA satellite, European Space Agency, set up a satellite called Mars Express, which sent the ill-fated Beagle lander onto Mars. Mars Express found traces of water in the poles, as well as frozen carbon dioxide. They also found frozen water. And so most recently, the Opportunity rover, which is NASA's rover,
Which is on the planet.
It's basically a robotic geologist has found definite evidence of that there has been water on Mars.
So it hasn't found water.
It has found evidence that there has been water. In fact, they think the area that Opportunity is in was once a lake, totally soaking in water, just based on the evidence they found.
Well, that's good, right? Water's good.
Okay. So have they found life? No, but that's the next thing they're going to try to be inferring. Oddly enough, these rovers weren't built to look for life. They were just meant to look for water.
Okay.
Beagle was made to look for life, which was the one that didn't work.
It didn't make it.
So will we find life on Mars? Who knows?
Detecting life remotely is actually kind of hard. I mean, defining life is actually kind of hard. So
actually, the fact of running the rovers on Mars is just incredible. The most complex operation that's ever been attempted via robotic explorers. They're going to do an arm movement. These explorers have these arms on them that can go out and do different things. They're going to send up 490 commands for this arm to go through. And this is twice as many as they've ever tried before. And, you know, basically this is go to this rock, look at this rock, take your grinder, do a grind on the rock, turn the grinder around, look at it with spectrometer, do a whole series of operations. And it's...
And tell us what happens later.
Right. They said that this would take a geologist maybe 20 minutes. You know, walk over to the rock, whack open
how
the
long
rock,
will
look at the rock.
How long will it take the robot to do?
It's going
to
take all day if everything goes smoothly. But with 490 commands, they're not sure if it's going to happen or not.
Wow. And the idea being is they have to give all the commands to it right now so it can do its actions. You can't tell it, okay, lift the rock up, because then you've got to wait 8 minutes for it to come back and say, okay, the rock is lifted. And it would take even longer.
I think it's 30 minutes. 30
minutes.
Round
so,
trip.
All right. So I was thinking 20
minutes.
So the guys
like
controlling
that.
The are going to be taking a lot of coffee breaks.
Yeah. Yes, I wonder what they do in the meantime.
John, I want to thank you for the Mars update. Do you have a little bit more?
Sorry. Oh, just that Spirit has now traveled. Spirit's the first rover to land. It has now traveled 195.25 meters, which is like just over 600 feet, which makes it the most explored robotic rover ever on another planet, which, again, it would have taken a geologist half a day to do everything that this rover has done in the past 40 days. Not that I'm trying to say we should go to Mars in person, but just to put it in perspective of how difficult it is to control something that's this far away.
Who knows? Maybe the Beagle found life. Maybe some Martians got it.
I think it most likely found extreme heat and impact. John, thank you very much. The Geeks in general, thank you very much for the news. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. The Geeks this morning are Sean Cleveland, John Tracy, and Miles Elam. NVIDIA's Inforce technology has taken the computer industry by storm. First created for the Microsoft Xbox, it has breathed new life into computer gaming community and inspired smaller, more fashionable computers. Scott Baker, Senior Product Manager for NVIDIA, is here today, where he oversees development and execution of NVIDIA Inforce 2 platform and processors. And joining Scott is PR Manager for Inforce, Brian Del Rizzo. Scott and Brian, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Thanks for having us.
You guys were both very patient and quiet when we went through the news, had your mics on. You were great. So thanks for being quiet. But now we want you to talk about Inforce chipset, or as you like to call it, the Inforce Media and Communications Processor. So traditional terms calls this a chipset. What is a chipset?
Well, a chipset in...
And this is Scott.
A chipset is basically the part of the computer that handles the traffic to and from the peripherals, things like keyboards, mice, etc., traffic to and from graphics, a graphics controller, to and from the CPU, traditionally to memory. So it handles all the data moving back and forth throughout the PC.
So we talk, people are pretty familiar with the core pieces of the machine. You've got your hard drive, you've got your processor, you have memory that everyone always likes to expand, and then you have like your graphics card. Those are pretty common things that people replace and deal with. So those are four different elements. Are you saying that a chipset kind of manages the communications between those things?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. And traditionally, chipsets have been kind of a dumb technology,
mm-hmm.
kind of just a pass-through, a conduit of information, if you will.
Like railroad tracks kind of thing?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. Just a conductor saying, this goes from A to B.
Okay. But I'm assuming Inforce 2 is a little different than that.
Yeah. Actually, all of our media and communication processors, really our term to replace the term chipset, are more than just conduits of information. There's task-specific processing. There's network processing, audio processing, security processing, storage processing, to basically facilitate that transfer of traffic and offload the CPU.
Okay, so it's another processor, but it's not your central processor.
That's correct.
It's thinking, though.
That's correct.
And chipsets have always had to do some thinking because they have to do some kind of translation to different things, but this is thinking more.
Right. We're taking, traditionally, I'll use networking as an example. Most networking is done by the CPU. The CPU is actually executing instructions to handle all the network traffic. What we try to do with Inforce and our media and communications processors is to have the MCP, as we call it, actually do some of that processing. It offloads the CPU, enabling the CPU to do what it's best at, which is execute instructions for applications.
There's a hard drive controlling device, Sean, I think I'm forgetting the name of it, but basically where the hard drives can be set into a certain form where the processor does all the control and management of the hard drive, and it really bogs down the CPU.
Yeah, it's programmed input-output, PIO.
PIO.
That was the original form of...
And so whenever you access the hard drive, the processor was really just had to take its time and do that. And hard drives have gotten smarter where the controlling can happen on the hard drive to an extent. And what you're saying is that the chipset's actually doing more of that now.
That's correct.
Okay, I want to give it in a form that most people can digest because it's kind of networking. Even discussion of what networking is a little complex. But let's see if we can get a simple one. Let's do the hard drive one. Let's say prior to Inforce chipset in the motherboard and doing the communication between the hard drive and the processor. If the processor wanted to get a file from the hard drive to do some translation in like Photoshop to do a filter or something on it, what was the processor doing that now your communications processor does?
Well, storage, hard drives in this case, are an okay example, but...
Not the best. Okay.
Not really. Let me,
okay.
But serial ATA, with the new standard.
Serial ATA, or even something like audio. Enforce 2 has an audio processor. We call it the APU. Traditionally, audio has been handled strictly by the CPU. And audio is very CPU intensive.
When you mean handled, like if you want to adjust... Like, what kind of things was the processor doing before that it doesn't do anymore in audio?
The processor was basically handling all the voices, all the sound, all the transfers of memory,
okay.
of information to and from memory. Now the audio processor in Enforce 2 is doing all of that. You can see CPU utilization drop dramatically. Enforce 2 has the only real-time Dolby digital encoder. So we're able to handle all sorts of processing that traditionally was handled either with very expensive add-in cards or by the CPU. And when the CPU is doing a lot of that work in audio, it's not doing the things it's meant to do, and that's execute instructions in your game, for example.
Okay, I got that.
So Scott, would that be AC97 audio that's still on a lot of motherboards?
AC97 is strictly soft audio.
And that soft audio takes a lot of processor...
Substantial processing
time,
power.
Especially when you're in a game.
Yes, correct.
Yeah.
So when you're in a game and you're surrounded by that three-dimensional soundscape Dolby Digital provides, you're talking about a lot of that is actually the processor working overhead to do that.
Those chips don't even support that high-end audio.
Oh, they don't. Okay.
Yeah. A lot of the features of high-end audio these days are not supported in that chipset. So you're getting the basic bare-bones audio.
In a standard chipset.
In a standard
right.
set.
In the Enforce chipset, they've taken audio to the next level. It's all hardware.
You know, it's interesting, talking about the show to try to get the concept of this in layman's terms, we're not succeeding completely at this point, but I want to try to attack this with metaphor. So if you can think about the processor being the executive of the machine, you can think of the chipset as being a really good executive assistant. Kind of like getting things prepared to pass off to do. So the executive or the processor itself is only doing the most crucial or the bigger picture projects. And the stuff that can be handled that's kind of routine is handled by the chipset. And we've seen that in a lot of devices, the idea that a chipset that or a support chips taking load off. So let's talk a little bit about, now we've kind of talked about what it really is doing, let's talk about some of the features that are in it, that kind of buzzwords and stuff. Let's talk about the North Bridge and South Bridge and what's happened.
Okay.
First, what's a North Bridge?
A North Bridge is the chip that connects directly to the CPU. The North Bridge also traditionally connects to it has a memory controller and it connects directly to memory.
Okay, so North Bridge traditionally was the tie between your processor and your memory. That's a pretty important piece.
Correct. And the processor and your graphics card.
Okay.
And the processor and all the rest of the I.O.
Okay.
All your toys, whether it's all your other buses, whether it's your PCI bus,
all the cards
USB
you slip
devices.
In.
Yes. Anything you connect to the system is handled in the South Bridge, which
okay.
the North Bridge sits between the South Bridge and the CPU.
So basically these bridges used to be all the communications and pass through, and you're getting rid of the North Bridge and South Bridge, right? Or changing it.
Correct. With Enforce 3, which supports the AMD Athlon 64 and Athlon Opteron, Athlon 64 FX family, that architecture from AMD now integrated the memory controller in the CPU.
Okay.
So one of the major needs for the North Bridge, if you will, is now part of the CPU. So
takes out a middleman.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. So what that enabled us to do essentially was in Enforce 3 combine the two chips, traditionally what you call the North Bridge and the South Bridge, into a single chip solution.
Because now you don't have to do the focus of the memory, which is the thing that's kind of the speed intensive part.
Right. That's traditionally a pretty large part of the chip.
Uh-huh.
There's many pins to make that chip real big. When that part left the North Bridge, we were able to integrate very highly what was left of the North Bridge into a single chip solution, a single chip MCP. And there's benefits to that. Latency, which is kind of latency is, the less latency you have, the less waiting you have.
Mm-hmm.
So there is overhead going from one chip to another over a bus, even when that's a high-speed bus.
So when you used to have that north and south bridge, the communications between those added communication time.
Right,
what you're
right.
Saying.
There's
Sorry.
Always some kind of delay.
I just got to ask, what's MCP?
MCP, Media and Communications Processor.
Okay, just make sure it wasn't a Tron reference to, like, Master Control Program.
It's similar in a lot of ways.
I hadn't thought of that.
In some ways, it is kind of similar.
So what is the communication pipeline that you're doing between the processor and Enforce your MCP?
The
communications?
Oh, so the processor and the MCP are connected through hypertransport.
Okay, what's hypertransport?
Hypertransport is a standard that I guess was really started by AMD, but it's an open standard.
Okay.
Lots of people use it. Transmeta uses it. Apple uses it. We use it exclusively. In fact, just a little tidbit of information. We've shipped more hypertransport devices than any other company in the world, including AMD, actually.
Okay. Well, NVIDIA is a big company, so it does make sense. You're
getting
a lot of content.
The Xbox.
Xbox has a hypertransport interface between, I'll stay with the traditional terms, the North Bridge and the South Bridge that we have on the Xbox.
So the Xbox still does have those two different components. So the memory controller does go through that that North Bridge.
That's correct. The Xbox is a very traditional PC architecture. There's a CPU, North Bridge, South Bridge.
And the Xbox, of course, is Microsoft's gaming console. Now, the Xbox, when it was first launched, I mean, right before it was launched, there was a lot of talk that the processor in it would be AMD processor. And then right before it launched, Intel stepped in, and now the processor inside the Xbox is an Intel processor. So is that one of the reasons why you had to have the North Bridge in there, because you were using an Intel processor in that board, or was AMD not at that point?
The interface between the North Bridge and the CPU would be any number of things. On the Xbox, for example, it's an Intel Pentium 3 front-side bus.
Okay.
If it was an AMD processor, it would have been hypertransport. The interface doesn't necessarily matter. We have...
The North Bridge is doing the communications conversion between Intel's front side bus, which connects North Bridge to the CPU, and the hypertransport bus, which connects your two chips together.
Correct.
But if they hadn't used an Intel processor, AMD has hypertransport built directly into the chip. It could have all been hypertransport. But they would have still had a North Bridge.
Right, correct. That's
so
correct.
It wouldn't have made much difference.
We talk about, the people in the room here, we're all talking about hypertransport, like, yeah, hypertransport. But let's talk a little bit more in detail about what hypertransport is.
Okay.
We understand it's a communication line. Is it equivalent to, like, phone lines? Is that the kind of concept it is?
Go ahead.
I launched the Hypertransport Consortium.
And wrote
the representative.
White paper.
So, hypertransport is a high-speed, low-pin count, point-to-point chip interconnect.
Serial.
So, it's serial.
Well, I'm glad we cleared that up.
And what I mean by all that is, unlike PCI, which was used to connect the North Bridge and South Bridge in the past, and there are other proprietary technologies, which are more parallel-based, which means it's one direction at a time. Serial technologies transfer data both directions simultaneously, and they do it over fewer wires.
Okay.
So, and hypertransport can actually run up to 800 megahertz and transfer upwards of, I think the limit at a 32-bit bus is 12 gigabytes per second. That's aggregate total bandwidth.
Sean, thanks for clearing that all up. I appreciate that.
Hypertransport is great. For the future, we need it.
Okay. Really fast communications bus for on-motherboard communications.
Stay with your analogy.
Sure.
It's a phone line between the North Bridge and the CPU. It's just a very fast...
It's a fiber optic line.
Yes, fiber. Yeah, there you go.
So we got that CEO as the processor, the executive as the processor, and the assistant as this the North Bridge, basically North Bridge South Bridge combination, which now we're calling which you're calling the Enforce chipset, if you will, but also the media communications processor, and those two beings represent the executive and the executive assistant, and the communication between them in the office is a fiber optic telephone. So it's
right.
Like really fast communications,
right.
Effectively. So that's what we're talking about. Now, it also, the chipset's not dealing with the memory anymore as directly. Your Enforce 3.
Enforce 3, right.
Won't be managing the communication between the processor and the memory. The processor will now go to the memory more directly using hypertransport.
Right.
But what happens now when the graphics card, like the AGP graphics card, wants to use the memory? How does it get to the memory?
It gets to the memory through basically the media communication processor and the CPU. the traffic is handled conceptually the same way it always was. There's pros and cons to that. One pro is memory being very close to the CPU. The CPU is the device that has to access memory the most.
Right.
Is very beneficial. One of the cons is some of the other devices that have to access main memory have another device in between. The CPU is now in between. But the truth is, the pros really kind of outweigh the cons, and the overall system performance can actually rise quite a bit.
Right, because the CPU, of course, is going to be using the memory more than anybody else.
Right.
All right. Well, I like the idea that communications processor is doing more brains, and I'm a little confused how that exactly works. Sean, do you want to say something?
Well, before we get to that real quick,
yeah.
I wanted to ask, between Enforce and GeForce, your video chipset,
mm-hmm.
So if somebody buys a GeForce video card and plugs it in their AGP slot in an Enforce motherboard, is there anything special there between the two?
I mean, anything beneficial going on?
Any beneficial going on?
There's no hidden secret sauce, if you will. There's not, you know, our drivers don't say, oh, if GeForce is installed, then run extra fast. But obviously, with the two engineering departments right next to each other and the driver teams in early development from day zero, we're able to optimize for the combination of the two.
That's what I was wondering.
Both devices are industry standard, you know, industry compatible with any other competitors, either chipsets or graphics cards. But together, there is a benefit, but it's more from a QA and quality perspective. We're able to optimize. We can go ask the graphics guys, you know, what are some of the things? What are some of your strengths and weaknesses? And we can optimize in our drivers
right.
as well.
Where the drivers is probably where you get the biggest benefit.
Right.
But you guys have a unified driver architecture, which
right.
means that one piece of software supports all of your cards.
That's correct. Unified driver architecture is really not a software kind of architecture, believe it or not. Even though we call the driver a unified driver architecture, the way you can get away with that, the way you can implement that, has to be done in hardware. Basically, we have an analogy that we talk about a lot on our graphics side. Every graphics processor may draw a triangle differently. The way the architecture of the chip is, it may create that triangle very differently. A unified driver architecture basically creates a layer of hardware in between that does translation. So the driver just has to say, draw me a triangle. And there's a layer of hardware then that translates that simple command into
all the commands
and this vertex here, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Right. Right. Now, we apply that same kind of technology to network processing, audio, et cetera.
So basically things that are done a lot in that genre, the networking or the audio, you kind of put into a hardware solution so that you can offload all the commands necessary. Just a simple command says, do this, and it does more complex
right.
stuff for you.
And the benefit of a unified driver architecture is the driver today can be forward compatible and backwards compatible with different generations of hardware.
Right.
Our driver today will run on hardware that we release in 2 years.
Love that idea. I'm sick of getting old peripherals. You upgrade your machine, all of a sudden your peripheral, you can't use that peripheral anymore. Scanners are real common for that kind of thing. I wish that was extended outside the processor or the motherboard.
Have you ever taken a system and you've changed your motherboard or changed a graphics card and all of a sudden you got to start over,
right.
load all your drivers from scratch. You've got, you know, Windows doing its thing. We had a great example of how outstanding the unified driver architecture really works. Big customer in the Northeast, a utility company, bought a version of an HP PC based upon Enforce One a couple of years ago. And then during their evaluation for their next generation of PCs, they bought Enforce Two. They took their hard drive out of an Enforce One system, dropped it into Enforce Two, and it just worked.
Oh, nice. No installing anything.
Their IT department told us it saved them weeks and weeks of QA and you know, reloading and rebuilding their image. That's how, in the simple terms, that's what UDA does for you.
That's great.
This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. If you have questions or comments, the phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-4255. 5877. You can use the internet. Visit geekspeak.org. Click on the Geeks and then send a message. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks Sean Cleveland, Miles Elam, and John Tracy, and our guests Scott Baker and Brian Del Rizzo of NVIDIA. This program is supported by a grant from Cruise.io, providing internet services including DSL and spam filters, PHP, MySQL, and now with nationwide access. Information about Cruise.io membership is available online at cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301. We're being pretty technical this hour of Geek Speak, and if you'd like to call in with questions that are not related to chipset or NVIDIA chipset technology, you're welcome to do so. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. We'll take any of your computer-related questions or comments or technology-related questions or comments. But, of course, if you want to know about what NVIDIA is doing, what the Inforce Tech chipset is doing, you're welcome to call in about that, too.
Hello. Lyle.
Hey, he's getting teared up or something.
Yeah. Okay, so so with the unified driver architecture, I know I've had this problem where I've taken a hard drive into another computer, and I get the blue screen. You know, Windows 98 comes up for the first time. It's just not going to work. Or not how 98, Windows XP. You can't just move Windows XP to another computer. But with Inforce, if you stay with the various technologies, you could do that.
And it applies to Inforce and GeForce. Yeah, that's big benefits, easily upgradable. So, you know, graphics card, another example. When you buy one of our next generations of graphics cards, you just drop it in and it works.
Yeah.
It's compatible. Now, there's still reason to want to potentially go out and download a new driver to take advantage of some of the latest features, which you just can't turn on, in a legacy driver.
How do you guys keep doing that? How do you add features and performance with the driver? Because it's pretty amazing that you guys can do that.
Yeah, boy, we have such a world-class software organization. That's really part of the key. But, you know, when we release a new piece of hardware, our goal is to release that hardware with a driver that's very stable, gives the user outstanding, stable experience. We maximize our performance to meet a certain shipping time frame. Our software team then can spend sufficient time, many months of optimizing code paths to go in and really make sure every code path is as fast as it possibly can be.
I see.
That's a huge amount of effort.
And those code paths change with each generation of hardware, too.
Well, it's potentially, yeah, but it's software code paths. During making things super compatible and super stable, you're constantly tweaking your software. Well, pieces of the code to fix bugs and things like that are sometimes can slow things down. These guys, once the product is shipping, they go back in and they basically start undoing everything. They look at how many nanoseconds an instruction would take to execute, and they try to streamline.
Wow.
It's a tremendous amount of work, and that's how they get the. It's not like we've been hiding anything in reserve.
In the past, you could choose different types of drivers. You know, WQL support or not. So WQL, WHQL, is Windows Hardware Qualification. I don't know what the L stands for. But
Lab.
So they actually take a look at your driver and say, yes, this is going to be, this is going to work with Windows. Right. And then they put their stamp of approval on it, and then you guys release it. Are all of your drivers WQL?
Our goal is to always have a WQL driver available on the web for all of our products. We'll occasionally, if we have some really new and exciting technology, really new performance or feature improvements in the drivers, we might put some out there that are not,
right.
not yet.
And that's basically because it takes a while to go through WQL?
Yeah, there's a time frame, and you have to make sure you meet all the WQL standards. But if we have something new and exciting that we want to get out, we'll certainly do that.
Enthusiasts kind of demand that, don't
they? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Now, I understand that you two are, of course, not the NVIDIA graphic card experts, but we do have a call from Mike. And, Mike, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hey, thank you very much. Excellent program.
And your question is about graphics cards?
Yeah, I've got an NVIDIA graphics card. I suppose that's used to drive my monitor. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah, the monitors connect to your graphics card.
Okay, why would I have a NVIDIA logo on my startup bar open all the time? Does that need to be open? Do you know?
So I'm assuming you're talking about an NVIDIA logo in your bottom right?
Yes.
Okay, there's basically a desktop manager that if you click that has all sorts of capabilities that you may or may not be interested in, depends on how you use your system, allows you to quickly go in and manage your refresh rate and resolution, your color depth. We support something in our graphics called NView, which is N number of monitors, N being greater than one, where you can have dual, tri, quadruple, independent displays. All that is done by hitting that little NVIDIA icon in the lower right.
So what you're saying is if in XP I have five different users in my house, five different people can have five different resolutions on the monitor?
That's correct. And you would obviously then in Windows be setting up different profiles for them, so they have to log in differently. But actually with our newest driver, we have extensive, I think it's 56.56 that was just posted recently or soon should be. You can have pretty extensive profile management on a per user or even a per game kind of basis.
Really?
Yeah.
And you have, do you have, hang on just a second, Mike. I want some clarity on that. Scott, do you have to have that desktop application running in that taskbar to be able to do those switching between graphic versions on
in-game? Yeah, I believe that installs automatically when you install the
driver. And so that's why that's there, to get to the richer features of what you support.
Right. Most now, people, frankly, you know, don't go in and mess with it. Once the driver's loaded...
Right,
and you can turn that off too, right? If you go into the display properties and go to the advanced.
Yeah, that's the trick, Mike. If you don't want that logo down your bottom right-hand corner or that application running that gives you advanced features, if you don't need them, go ahead and click on it and then go to advanced, and you should be able to find a little checkbox that says don't launch this application or don't show this application in the taskbar, and that should do it for you.
Does it really matter? I mean, is it taking up that much room in my instant memory to have that open, or is it just a good idea to keep that area clean?
I think if it's just running, you're not using it, it's probably not taking much at all.
Yeah.
But if you have multiple desktops, you know, set through InView.
The trick, though, definitely, Mike, that's something to focus on when your computer using Windows. You want to know what those things are that are running all the time. Normally, virus checkers that normally have an icon down there. A graphics support card, I mean, you probably paid a bit for your graphics card, so it kind of makes sense to allow the company to have the software running. They've made the assumption that it's a good thing to do. But then again... The company, of course, is moving from a lot of different formats. They've got to market, too, and their icon down your lower right helps them marketing as well. And you got to kind of judge that. Miles, you have an opinion on this?
Yeah, and from a software engineering point of view, if you have a program that's down there that you aren't using, chances are Windows is just going to swap it out of main memory onto the hard drive. It's not really going to impact your memory usage. I wouldn't worry about it.
Yeah, so Mike, go ahead and leave it there, like you said.
You know, InView has a cool little feature that I like. You can actually turn your windows transparent when you move them. So
yeah, I notice you always turn your machines on like that.
It's pretty cool because I like to see what's behind it, you know.
Sure.
Well, because you get lost in all the windows too, right?
Yeah, totally.
So,
Mike, did that help you answer your question?
Yeah, you guys are awesome. Thanks very much.
Thanks for the call.
Bye.
And we're going to go ahead and jump right into Eric, also from Santa Cruz. Eric, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. I just wanted to ask about follow up on one of those news items with the increase in the laptops or LCD monitors. About how much are they going to increase?
It'll be about $6 to $10, depending on the device.
So when we're talking about a $600 monitor.
And we're only talking about laptop computers and LCD, liquid crystal display monitors.
Right. So really, since you know the price of technology, generally speaking, decreases, although not always, the total price might be less after July 1st than before.
Yeah, in fact, last week we covered in an article that there's a glut of LCD displays available in, I believe...
I think the 15 and 17-inch ranges.
Yeah, and I'm not sure where they're coming from right now, but there's a lot of them. So the prices are going to be decreasing relatively soon. So the decrease in price on them and the increase of this $10 kind of recycling fee, we probably won't see much of a difference. But the difference in monitor costs from California to Oregon, for example, could be pretty different if Oregon doesn't have a law that's similar. Because, of course, companies are going to have to go through another layer of bureaucracy, and they'll probably... You know, even though the cost only goes up $10, it'll probably turn into $50 for the consumer. Yeah. But then again, the prices are decreasing, as you said, so much that you might not even notice the difference, even as a retailer of LCDs.
And then what about, you know, how there's so much commerce over the Internet? And if you buy something out of state, is that fee going to still be applied?
I would think yes.
It depends on how that law
is.
Well,
actually, yeah. You know, I don't know, over the Internet. They really don't.
It's hard to be specific about
that. You don't pay sales tax if you're...
Yeah.
You buy something from us.
If you're in California, you buy from somebody in California, you'll have to pay it. But yeah, outside of the state, if you're buying from California, yeah, it's a whole different ballgame.
It depends on how Congress passes. There's a lot of legislation going through about.
I thought you say it was a state law.
Get rid of
it's a California state law.
Miles is referring to Miles is referring to internet laws that are federal at this point and are being changed. So we'll see a difference. But I'm assuming that in the short term, a monitor being sold from a company outside of California won't deal with that issue. Only the retailers will deal with that issue.
I had another comment about you were talking about some of these new viruses going around that look like they're innocuous or they're from your internet provider or something like that. One thing I noticed was I've been getting a bunch of emails that have the complete domain name in the sender's email address, which is pretty unusual. So it's just it'll be like johnsmith@ruthbio.com, whereas usually that's just the user's name. It doesn't have the whole.
Yeah, that would be a good tip-off.
Yeah, definitely a good tip-off that it's just an email address and doesn't actually have a name. Thank you very much for the call. Eric from Santa Cruz. Let's get back into NVIDIA chipset, but first I want to invite people. You are listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Trox. The Geeks this morning, Sean Cleveland, Miles Elam, John Tracy, and our guests, Scott Baker and Brian Del Rizzo of NVIDIA. We're taking your calls with questions and comments pertaining to NVIDIA's technology or technology in general. The numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. You can use the internet, visit geekspeak.org, click on the Geeks, and then send a message. I'm going to jump over to Brian because, Brian, you've been so quiet. Hi.
Hey, Scott's doing a good job.
Yeah, okay, good. So you're basically here to slap Scott down if he does something wrong.
I got to make sure he says the right thing. But, it's funny because in your news stories, you were talking about the virus stuff and also the Mars stuff. And I wasn't sure if you guys knew, but there's NVIDIA technology used by NASA right now to reconstruct all the data that they're getting back from the rovers. And we're able to help them kind of map it on a 3D terrain.
So NVIDIA is really, the way I know NVIDIA is through their GeForce cards, their graphics cards. They're kind of the big name, one of the two big names of graphic cards. And so it makes sense that if you're doing 3D modeling, you don't want a hardware company in there to help. I'm assuming they've got a lot of data. And how are they using your cards? Do they just have PCs there sitting around with your cards in them?
I don't know if they're general consumer PCs, but I'm assuming they're using some kind of workstation using our professional line of graphics. And they're getting the data, and our graphics solutions are helping them translate that data into 3D terrain models so then they can actually visualize where the rovers are actually going. So it's actually kind of exciting stuff.
Yeah, it is.
It's pretty neat.
Go ahead, Scott.
You guys also, there was a news story, and a caller mentioned it, about the viruses. Security is such a big topic nowadays with people trying to hack your computers, everything. One of the things we've done in our most recent Enforce 3 product, our Enforce 3 250, which has been launched already and should be available in just truly a matter of a couple of weeks, is we actually have a firewall built into the product. And what a firewall does, in simple terms, is it blocks external access to ports in your system.
Okay.
Prevents hackers from coming in and getting control of your system or corrupting your...
Is this a hardware firewall?
It's a hardware-optimized firewall. So it's we have a Gigi networking controller that's built into the MCP, and that's paired with our firewall technology.
Sorry,
Gigabit Ethernet controller. Yeah, sorry.
So what we're talking about when we were talking about networking earlier in your chipset actually handling networking, we're talking about onboard networking where there's actually an Ethernet port right on the motherboard, and that's pretty common now for motherboards. In fact, I don't know if you could buy a motherboard without one at this point.
Well, it's pretty common, but the issue is that not all solutions are created equal, right?
Right.
So the fact that we've been able to integrate it into the chip means we have lower latency, so we have higher throughput, lower CPU utilization, things like that. If you compare our networking solution to, say, if you went to the store of Fry's and you bought a Intel PCI Gigi solution and you plugged it into your PCI slot in your PC, you probably get about half the throughput that we can provide by doing an internal solution.
Because PCI has
an inherent latency, right? Because it's slow.
Latency.
But by bringing inside the chip, we're able to remove those bottlenecks. We have high-speed data interconnects inside our chips to help increase the throughput and lower the CPU.
And also you're limited by the number of cards you're using in PCI, because PCI is a shared bandwidth between all of the slots.
So now you have me curious, as a Linux user, are any of those features documented for use?
We provide Linux drivers. We don't provide open source drivers. And part of that, frankly, remember I mentioned the unified driver architecture and the benefits of it? Providing open source really gives you hardware access very differently than other companies because of our unified driver architecture. So we're reluctant to give open source drivers to the Linux community.
But not to annoy the entire Linux community that's listening, we do try to support you guys. We do have Linux drivers on NVIDIA.com. And for the new Enforce 3250 GB, which includes the integrated firewall, we will have Linux support coming out a little shortly as well.
Great. Okay. We got a call from Dan in San Miguel. Dan, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hey, good morning. Need some advice. Need some good spam killer.
You want a spam killer? Okay. You're getting what email client are you using?
Outlook Express.
Outlook Express. Okay. And
I'll take this off the air.
Okay.
Because I'm on the cell phone.
So. We'll address that. Thank you, Dean, for the call. San Miguel. Basically, a good solution for Dan to get rid of the spam that he's getting in Outlook Express. He probably has a pretty public email address and gets a lot of spam. Sean, what was your solution? You used to be using Outlook, not Outlook Express, but they're really similar. What do you do for spam?
Okay, I got a new email client.
You did. You dropped Outlook Express.
So I don't use Outlook Express or Outlook at all anymore.
But Outlook Express is a free client, and it's a big reason why people use it, because when you come, when you get Windows, you get Outlook Express for free.
The email client I went to is free. So I went to Mozilla, and I downloaded Thunderbird, and it's a completely free email client that has many advanced features, and one of them is a smart spam filter, which catches, I say, 95, probably even more than that, of my spam intelligently.
Miles, how does this intelligent spam filter work?
The technical, I don't know exactly. However, it basically takes a every email that comes through, it will do a hash of it. It'll basically do a mathematical analysis of it, just like break it down into its component pieces, and then take that as a pattern or a template for how spam is.
It's actually even more than that too. That's great, because there's a lot of great technology in spam filtering, but What Thunderbird does is it actually wants to be trained on what spam is. So it takes a look at your address book and all your contacts, and it makes sure that anything in there is not going to be, you know, sent to the junk box.
So you add your contacts as a whitelist.
And that's standard. But they take it one step further, and they want you to rate your email in the beginning as what's junk and what's not. So you're actually training it, too.
And you can actually, as it learns spam, you can actually go check your spam filter and then uncheck it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
This functionality is completely duplicated, really, in Apple's Mail program, which comes with OS X, the program called Mail. And it does the same type of thing. John, am I right on that? You use Mail.
Yeah.
And basically, spam, you train the system. But Outlook doesn't support that. So I think all the geeks that are using Windows machines have switched over to Thunderbird. Thunderbird is Mozilla.org's open source application for mail. It's a mail client. You can get it by going to Mozilla. Spell it, Miles.
Mozilla.org.
And then click on Thunderbird for the product you want. And you can use it on Macintosh and Linux as well. So that's the solution for spam. Then the first week or so, you're going to be training it. And after you're done training it, it should get pretty good at getting all your spam. It gets about, I would say, 90% of my spam. I get about 90 messages a day.
You don't have to worry about the Outlook viruses, you know, that are being sent out.
Not as much, yeah. That's definitely true. Yeah. And we have Henry from Monterey. Henry, you've got two questions for us. What's your first one?
Hi there. First one has to do with LCD displays. There are two types of interfaces to an LCD display. One is the standard video monitor display. The other one is a digital interface. And I'm curious if your representatives from NVIDIA are seeing a quality difference in the image generated depending upon which interface you used.
It's a great question.
Brian, you seem to be nodding your head.
The easiest answer there is digital is always better. It's going to be a cleaner signal. Now, having said that, there are going to be differences in terms of the digital quality as well. And for that, I don't have the testing results in front of me, but you can check any of the enthusiast sites online. Extreme Tech is one of them, who have actually done digital quality tests on different graphics cards, and they can kind of see which cards have the better output.
But from the digital analog, you say, like, hands down, the digital lines can be cleaner?
Yes, most definitely.
Okay.
Hands down.
So there's your answer. Henry, you have a...
And the length, too, can be longer.
On digital. Yeah.
Do you know how long?
I don't.
So basically, Henry, if you have an analog signal going between your computer and the motherboard, and that's traditional cable, it's actually an analog cable,
right.
VGA, super VGA, inductance that can happen on that line will cause blurriness effects, shadowing, things of that nature. So you have to have the cable relatively short, and you have to have a very thick, relatively short cable, because the longer you get, the more inductance will happen, and the more visual effects will happen on the monitor that you don't want. So the digital one basically starts, it's able to ignore a lot of the effects because it's not in an analog mode. It doesn't care about small deviations like that that would affect the picture. It's just a digital signal. So you can make the cable a lot longer, and you can actually make it a little bit thinner. So I hope that answers your question. You have a second one. Please, go ahead.
Yes, thank you. My second question is, I would like to set up a system that has multiple monitors, and I noticed that your guest said that they can, using a single NVIDIA, have multiple display multiple views on a single monitor.
Yeah.
But I would actually like to configure a computer with multiple physical flat panels, if I can afford it.
Okay.
And I want to know how they do it and if they support it.
Henry, thanks for the call. We'll answer that right now.
So I assume this is more from a graphics card perspective. The vast majority of our graphics cards, from even entry level price points all the way up to our super Ferrari versions, support multiple monitors. Typically, those cards have a VGA or an analog output, and also a DVI or digital output on them. So almost every one of our graphics cards supports the ability to have two physical monitors connected to your system, and those are two independent displays. But you can drag and drop from one panel to another. Very, very beneficial in a work environment, especially.
And if you have if you don't have a DVI flat panel and you have two CRTs with the older analog plug, you can get a converter.
That's correct. There is a converter that takes the DVI is actually a dual technology. It's both digital and analog. And so what you'll do is there's small dongles. There's probably $10. Eight inches long or so, that convert that digital output to an analog signal for your flat panel.
So if you get one of your GeForce cards that you're selling right now, there'll be those two connectors on. You get a dongle if you don't have it, and then you can connect two monitors to that one card
Let me clarify something for the listeners. When you go to buy a graphics card, look what the manufacturer of the graphics card is actually providing on the card, because some will have two analog, some will have an analog and digital, some will have a digital and a TV out. So there's all sorts of combinations, but the short answer is all of our graphics chips support multiple monitors environments.
For these graphics cards, though, on the box it will say you can use two monitors for this, I'm assuming?
It should say that. It should talk about our NVU technology, but it should be more specific in terms of what actual ports are on the card.
Let's say someone already has an AGP graphics card and they want to get another card. Are there PCI cards to do second graphics?
There are. There are PCI cards that will allow you to basically expand your system. In fact, we have in our Quadro line of professional graphics, we have PCI cards where you can put 2, 3, 4 cards in.
Yeah.
Most of those cards actually also support four. Many of those boards support four displays.
Wow. Oh, really?
A high-density connector. Yeah, two high-density connectors that each fan out into a Y, essentially.
Great. Well, the wonderful question about dual monitors, I'm always curious about that. I love that the newest GeForce cards, you can actually get one card that will do both those.
Mm-hmm.
It's great. It's wonderful to be doing a lot of things and have your email client off to the side and your main work on the main monitor. It's a wonderful feeling. I do that with the PowerBook. The Apple PowerBooks actually have that built in. I think mine actually has a GeForce NVIDIA card in it.
Right.
All right, we're not going to be able to take any more calls today.
Oh, my gosh, so many questions.
So many questions, so little time.
I think I want to do is write an article and take a bunch of my questions, have you guys answer them, and post it up on GeekSpeak.
I think that might be a good way. Do you guys want to cover something else? We've got a couple more minutes. Any other questions you had, Sean, for them?
Right yeah, now? Actually, I think one of the things that I find maybe not quite confusing but intriguing, is the dual DDR support in M-Force, dual-channel DDR.
M-Force 2.
But there's also dual-channel DDR memory. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of confused between the
two. So dual channel basically means there are two separate independent channels of data that can flow, or buses that allow data transfers to and from memory independently. You get tremendous bandwidth benefits when you can, instead of queuing commands to go get information from memory one behind another, you're able to basically, the memory controller is very smart, and it can predict what kind of memory accesses are going to be needed in the future, and it can start to queue those in two. It's like one line at the bank versus two. essentially. Okay. And so you get twice the bandwidth. And so for high bandwidth requirements, when you're doing a lot of multimedia or gaming, you see tremendous benefits in performance.
And this is just with standard DDR memory.
That's correct.
And also, I think people are confused that if you say you support DDR400 memory, they think they have to get that, but they don't.
Correct. You don't have to. DDR400 memory just represents the maximum speed capability, 400 megahertz of that DIMM. It can run at lower speeds, 266, 333, whatever right. your CPU is running at is where it will try to synchronize.
This program is supported by a grant from Seagate Technology. Seagate is a worldwide supplier of disk drives for PCs and servers and innovations for products like the Microsoft Xbox, digital video recorders, and digital jukeboxes. Information is at Seagate.com. Our guests today were Scott Baker and Brian Del Rizzo of NVIDIA. To learn more about NVIDIA and their Inforce 2 technology, visit www.nvidia.com. And thank you, Scott and Brian, for joining us on GeekSpeak today.
Thank you.
Our geeks this morning were Miles Elam, John Tracy, and Sean Cleveland. Our producer is Maggie Cleveland. Thank you all for participating in GeekSpeak. To those that called in, thank you for making GeekSpeak what it is. Without your calls, it would just be us geeking out. And who really wants to listen to that? This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Arturo, or on the web at kosp.org. For GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxell. Fine Print with Jen Remage is coming up next, followed by State of the Arts with my mother, Diana Wright Troxell. And at noon, my favorite music show, Two Steps in the Blues with Charlie Lang. Friday's a great day to listen to KOSP. Stay tuned now in just a minute for Fine Print.
So we're at this medieval castle, you know, near the highway, not far from the airport.
Good evening, my lords and lady. My name is Jim, and I'll be your serf tonight.
Are you a wench?
Yes, I am a wench.
Are you a drinks wench or a...
I'm a photo wench.
Fake medieval castles, wax museums, Civil War reenactments, in short, attempts to simulate worlds we have never been to. This week on This American Life.
Catch This American Life at its new time, Sunday at 10 a.m. on Central Coast Public Radio.